This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The International Day of the Victims of Enforced Disappearances is a very important day in that it reminds the civilized world, the free world, the peace and freedom loving people that out there are monsters amongst us who thrive on using coercion to suppress dissent.
That was Tatenda Mombiarara, a human rights defender in Zimbabwe and an abduction victim, explaining the significance of marking today for victims of abductions and disappearances. Details coming up. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. 31 members of the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum are urging UN Special Envoy Jan Kubis to meet with them urgently to address serious breaches in implementing the country's agreed-upon political roadmap. Meanwhile, Aguila Saleh, Speaker of the House of Representatives, said it will withdraw confidence in the government of national unity if Prime Minister Abdul Hamid Dabiba does not show up today for questions on government negligence in state institutions unification, electricity, COVID-19 and other issues. Dabiba says the legislature is hindering the government by delaying approval of the budget. Wolfgang Pochtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed the latest complications in the Libyan political scene with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The significance of the Libya Political Dialogue Forum is fading away, and those representatives have realized this and they want to come back and they want to make a new attempt. But there should have been an agreement on the constitutional basis for the upcoming elections already in June to be endorsed or approved by the HOR thereafter, and they are still far away from finding a consensus. Last February, the LPDF was successful in agreeing on a government of national unity, on the Baber's government, because there was a consensus to get rid of the Serraj government and of the Altini government. Now, there is no such a consensus, as there is a group of the LPDF members living very well with the current situation and therefore believing that the Dabeiba government should serve on. So I don't believe that we will see a comeback of the LPDF anytime soon.
But Aqila Saleh, Speaker of the House of Representatives, said there are no legislative or legal obstacles to holding the elections on time, but there are those who create obstacles for their personal interests in addition to those who fear leaving the political scene if the elections are held. How about the lack of constitutional basis for the December elections?
This depends on the point of view. One could certainly argue that the Constitutional Declaration of 2011, amended as of 2014, which served already very well in 2012 and 2014 as a basis for parliamentary elections, would now be also sufficient. Others argue that the country needs a final constitution after 10 years in order to end the transitional phase after the revolution before the next elections. And this is certainly a point of view from the High Council of State, which would not have a role if there in the future if there are elections now based on the constitutional declaration. Keeping the year-long debate about the 2017 draft constitution and its many weaknesses in mind, I would say it is entirely unrealistic to get to a final constitution anytime soon. So the discussion about the constitutional basis right now is a tool for those who want to delay the elections. I don't see any real reason why the constitutional declaration from 2011, although it's not perfect, should not be good enough for the December elections.
Saleh also said the HOR will withdraw confidence in the government of national unity if Prime Minister Abdul Hamid Dabeiba doesn't show up at the questioning session today about the government's negligence in state institutions unification, electricity, and coronavirus, among other files. On the other side, Dabeiba said that the HOR is hindering the work of government by delaying the budget approval. What do you make of that exchange and the complications in the situation in Libya?
The political situation is certainly tensing. planning. While de Baber did not really deliver, not everything is his fault. However, he could not keep his promises, as you've indicated, about the economy, the daily supply of the population, and about the reunification of the institutions. Some are reunified only by name. The security situation in the greater capital area is worsening by the week. The preparations for the elections, which are one of the main purposes of the government, is more or less stuck. Many people in the East feel neglected by the de Baber government. But de Baber now has also a harder time in Misrata, where many of the militias do not fully support him, although he comes from Misrata. Salah Abadi, a hero from the revolution, a hardliner and one of the most influential militia leaders in Misrata, just complained that now the Turks control everything. An increasing number of influential businessmen accuse him behind the scenes of completely selling out the country to Turkey. Despite all Turkey friendliness, open policy towards Turkey is a problem, especially for those whose businesses relations are not mainly oriented towards Turkey, which is not a very solvent country. Regarding the budget, the GNU is entitled to spend 1/12 of the last year's budget every month, and they have already spent about 50 billion Libyan dinar. So in practical terms, the non-approval is not such a big issue for the government, as long as they do not want to spend significantly more money than last year. But this is actually what de Baber wants to do, and for some good reasons wants to do. He requested a budget increase of about 40% compared last year. Between the HOR, or let's say the bloc dominating the HOR around Aguila Saleh and Prime Minister de Baber and the High Council of State, the situation is increasingly tense. However, I would say a serious attempt to withdraw confidence from the GNU can only be expected if Saleh has an alternative ready, an alternative for the Prime Minister. He is, allegedly, in touch with several Prime Minister candidates, including the former Minister of the Interior, Fatih Başaga, who is from Misrata.
That was Wolfgang Poştay, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. A group that was mobilizing South Sudanese to protest against the government today says, although people did not turn out due to a heavy security presence in Juba and other parts of the country, calls for change will continue. A member of the People's Coalition of Civil Action, which was organizing the protest, told VOA South Sudan service that the security deployment shows the government is an autocracy. It appears access to the internet on cell phones has been disabled. Information and Telecommunications Minister Michael Makowi denies the government tampered with internet services, blaming it on technical problems. South Africans opposed to COVID-19 vaccines, lockdown restrictions and mandatory masks marched today to President Cyril Ramaphosa's offices in Pretoria, demanding an end to the measures aimed at halting the pandemic's spread. The protesters, who are part of the global anti-vaxxers movement, are accusing the government of planning to infringe on their rights after the Department of Health revealed it was considering options to make vaccination mandatory in the African country hardest hit by the coronavirus. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Away with vaccine! Away with the mask! Away with the lockdown! Enough is enough!
These are slogans that anti-vaxxers chanted as they headed to the seat of government at the union buildings. They made it clear that they have decided not to be part of anything that involves COVID-19 and that they want Ramaphosa to know it. Others like this woman, who preferred to be identified only as Patricia, accused the government of concealing the deaths of those they allege were killed by the vaccines.
The vaccine, I know of seven people who have died. They don't say it's a part of the vaccine. They just say it's pneumonia or some lie. They're murdering us.
The protesters were not wearing masks and were unapologetic.
Remove your mask!
The 9-year-old Spongeless Tebe, was angry at the government for allowing employers to threaten to dismiss workers who resist getting jabs. The discussions by the Department of Health about making vaccination compulsory made her even more upset.
I feel that it's not fair for someone to force me to go and take that vaccine. I don't want to take a vaccine.
A heavy police contingent met the protesters at the union buildings, refusing them access into the precinct until they put on masks. After a standoff, the marchers vowed to return. Lynette van Rooyen called herself the mother of all South Africans.
There are three poisonous substances in this jab. We are not animals. Leave us alone. We don't want the vaccine.
South Africa has vaccinated more than 12 million people out of its population of 60 million. However, fewer than 6 million people have received a full dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine or two shots of Pfizer. The government is blaming misinformation for the low intake and has dismissed the allegations that people have died due to the vaccine. The Minister of Health says making vaccines mandatory is one of the options being discussed to ensure the nation achieves its goal of vaccinating 70% of its population in an effort to reach herd immunity. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
South African police have arrested seven suspects in connection with the killing last week of a government official who helped expose a multi-million dollar corruption scandal. Last year, members of the Gauteng province's health department, business people tied to the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, and organized crime groups allegedly conspired to steal money meant for COVID-19 relief. Investigators say the department awarded fraudulent tenders to dubious companies for personal protective equipment, or PPE. Darren Taylor reports.
Babita Diokeren died last Monday when gunmen opened fire on her vehicle shortly after she dropped her child off at school. She was chief director of financial accounting in the health department of Gauteng, which includes the country's largest city, Johannesburg. Diokeren last year exposed several of her colleagues for alleged corruption and was said to be a star witness in an upcoming trial for South Africa's Special Investigative Unit, or SIU. The SIU has linked scores of high-profile people to the COVID corruption case. These include former Gauteng Health Minister Bandile Masuku and Kusela Diko, former spokesperson of President Cyril Ramaphosa. The SIU says the health department paid hundreds of millions of rands to companies with no previous record of services to the health sector for PPE that was never delivered. In some instances, say the investigators, the firms were paid 500% more than they should have been for PPE that turned out to be of poor quality.
Whistleblowers are at risk, there's no question about it, and something has to be done to reduce that risk.
David Lewis is director of the Corruption Watch NGO.
These are every bit as important as the police investigating the corruption, maybe more important because there could be no investigation without the preliminary information given by whistleblowers.
Organizations like his and citizens are asking why Diokeren was not assigned bodyguards given her status as a key in the SIU's case against several powerful people. The SIU responds that she didn't indicate she felt her life was in danger and that it's unsure that her death is related to her cooperation with it. Lewis is taken aback by the SIU's stance.
Look, and it's possible that the killing is unrelated to her whistleblowing activities and to her integrity and efforts to stop corruption. I doubt that that's going to be the outcome, because this is not the work of some disgruntled or scared executive of a company providing personal protective equipment. This looks like a professional hit. And we are really in trouble when organized crime and those who are corrupt meet each other and do this kind of thing.
Lewis says the masterminds behind Diokaran's killing shouldn't be difficult to find, because it's clear as daylight who stood to gain by getting her out of the way.
You know, as far as I know, there have been two very, very big tenders, maybe more than that. And, you know, if that's the case, then sure we know, or the police will know, who it is who stood to benefit from them. And I'd like to think that those will be first in line for a visit from the police.
But will the police make the necessary visits? Lewis points out that whistleblowers have been killed for decades in South Africa, so it's little wonder that few people have the courage to expose graft. In some cases, the informants appear to have been assassinated shortly after having approached law enforcement agencies. Most of these murders remain unsolved. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
It is International Day of the Victims of Enforced Disappearances, and reporter Kuzaza Nwashi in Harare reflects on what it means to victims in Zimbabwe and the use of abductions as a tool of oppression.
Tatenda Mombearara is a human rights defender and a victim of abductions. He explains to VOA the significance of this day.
The International Day of the Victims of Enforced Disappearances is a very important day in that it reminds the civilized world, the free world, the peace and freedom loving people that out there are monsters amongst us who thrive on using coercion to suppress dissent.
Rashid Mukundu is a political analyst. He tells VOA how abductions remain in the arsenal of the ruling ZANU-PF years after President Robert Mugabe was replaced by Emmerson Mnangagwa.
Abductions are actually a political weapon of coercion by ZANU-PF, and we are seeing a continuation of this abuse from the Mugabe era into the Mnangagwa era. And in fact, in the Mnangagwa era, we are actually seeing more frequent and regular use of abductions as a political weapon, not only to threaten opposition and human rights defenders, but also essentially to send a message that violence will be maintained and used as a way of controlling and subjugating political opponents.
Mombearara says the effects of abductions and torture are long-lasting.
Abductions, torture, and enforced disappearances are barbaric. And as a victim myself, I testify about the lasting physical, emotional, and psychological harm to survivors and their families. Some of the victims do not live to tell their stories and leave behind grieving loved ones and dependents who continue to suffer.
Mukundu worries that we are likely to see a continuation of the use of abductions as a tool for oppression, and that they may increase as we head into another election in 2023. Mombearara has been working towards a Never Again Fight Back campaign in a bid to make abductions a thing of the past through an organization called the Zimbabwe Survivors of Abductions and Torture Solidarity Trust. He pays tribute to all the victims who have not managed to live to tell their stories. For VOA, this is Kudzezu Nawashi from Harare.
The Botswana government has assured thousands of illegal immigrants they will not be left out of the COVID-19 vaccination program. The promise was made amid reports some were being rejected at vaccination centers. Mukandisi Dube reports.
Thousands of illegal immigrants are crossing into Botswana, the majority fleeing economic hardships in neighboring Zimbabwe. Some undocumented migrants say they are being turned away from vaccination centers, but Botswana's Assistant Minister of Health, Sithumo Lilatizu, told the National Assembly Friday no one, including immigrants, will be left out of the COVID-19 vaccination program. He said they've
immigrants and they are vaccinating them. Even those without documents, including refugees, are being vaccinated for COVID-19 because if they leave them out, their hospitals will be full tomorrow. Lilat Disisute said, Member of Parliament Ditapelo Kiorapetsi had asked during a National Assembly session whether illegal immigrants were being vaccinated. He said the migrants should be made aware of the service. He said he didn't understand why a record isn't being kept about the number of migrants who have been vaccinated in order to assist, inform and formulate a solid policy. He also said the migrants need to know they are eligible for vaccination. Mkululi Moyo is one of thousands of immigrants from neighboring Zimbabwe. He left his country seeking better economic opportunities. Moyo says his happy Botswana authorities have explained the policy on the vaccination of migrants.
I'm so happy because now Minister, he managed to clarify this issue of papers, especially as foreigners. We have this problem. So now it means everything is well now. We hope everything will go smooth according to what Minister has said, meaning everyone is going to be vaccinated.
Health authorities are emphasizing now they are unconditionally assisting undocumented migrants. Botswana deports an estimated 22,000 illegal immigrants every year, mostly from Zimbabwe. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Habaroni, Botswana.
Researchers say financing for climate initiatives in Africa, especially West Africa, will be important to limiting global temperature rise and achieving sustainable development. Kidane Araya, a climate finance strategist with the Wallace Global Fund, spoke to Ricky Shryock about climate finance in Nigeria and broader West Africa and how governments have so far underspent on these necessary initiatives.
The presence of this governmental gap of funding, different values-driven impact investors and environmental social governance have stepped up and really increased funding all over the world, including across Africa for climate finance. And investors that have funded adaption, resilience projects, and other just different climate adaptation projects is really an expanding opportunity in Nigeria and other West African countries that countries could really tap into. Acknowledging the absence of this strong intergovernmental coordination, one key project that comes to mind is the Shine Campaign, which is an example of a private fund that brings together investors, philanthropic donors, faith leaders, and different civil society advocates across Africa to really accelerate support and funding and investment for clean distributed energy solutions for some of the most marginalized communities across Africa. And they tend to fund initiatives that are led by women and ensure human rights in a ways that fossil fuel initiatives have failed to do across Africa.
What are the challenges to climate finance?
Yeah, I think the key challenges to climate finance and natural resource governance boils down to a lack of funding and political will to provide global South countries for the resources to mitigate climate risk, as well as corruption and corporate practices that continues to disrupt governance and climate action issues. You know, there's a clear inequity at the global level of financial resources necessary to tackle climate. Africa has committed less than 3% of global carbon emissions, yet will be one of the regions most impacted by the worsening climate crisis. And it's going to require heavy financial support to address climate. And there's been a variety of increased commitments by richer countries to curb their carbon emissions and provide funding for these lesser resource countries. And the UN reports that rich countries have actually yet to give their $100 billion to support climate finance in the global south, including in Africa. And so this will be a major point of discussion at the upcoming COP26 climate summit in Glasgow later this year.
What kind of climate finance initiatives are good for the communities living in these areas?
As evidenced in the IPCC climate report that just came out, the world must stop increasing carbon emissions entering in the atmosphere if we are to not go beyond the 1.5 Celsius degrees of warming. And the fact that the matter is the world is turning away from fossil fuels towards clean energy. So climate finance initiatives that embrace renewable, sustainable energy, and especially in rural West Africa, are really critical. And, you know, these initiatives must provide good paying jobs, long-term employment, protect biodiversity, waterways, forests, and provide populations with something they actually need, such as electricity. And I mean, the World Bank reports that 47% of Nigerians do not have access to grid electricity, and those that do have access face power cuts. So in thinking of these climate finance initiatives, how can we fund renewable energies that, you know, address and fill these gaps of energy needs?
That was Climate Finance Strategy with Wallace Global Fund, Kidan Araya, speaking with Ricky Shryock from Washington. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. Thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.